sent to me in my office by the House Chairperson, Fatima Hajaj, responsible for international relationship. There's an IPU conference in April. And so there's a matter that they're going to discuss. So I've requested that the documentation that she sent to me be sent to you. So a package is going to come your way. It's about three or four documents. They're basically resolutions. And that we are going to have to process and discuss. I'm just going to be tabling it formally to the meeting so that we then, at the next sitting of our meeting, we process those documents so that when they do go to the IPU, they at least have our mandate around those issues that will be on the table. So I just thought I should let you know that. Oh, the gentleman has got this now. Thank you very much. You can then ask one member from here. Yeah. Thank you very much. Welcome, Deputy Minister. I see you really want to stay as far away from me as possible so that you are surrounded by your team. I know it provides you with better confidence. That's what it's good, yeah.
I'm really lacking in self-confidence. I'm insecure. Especially in your presence.
I wonder why I allowed you to come into my meeting in the first place. Honourable members, let me just formally then read the letter from the the request to us. It's addressed to me from, as I said, Ms. Fatima Hajaj, House Chairperson of International Relations, on the 17th of February. These are IPU 124th IPU Assembly Standing Resolutions. Standing Committee Resolutions. Here's a background. Our Parliament will be participating in the 124th Interparliamentary Union Assembly meeting scheduled to take place from the 15th to the 20th April in Panama City. The Speaker will be leading a delegation of 8 members of Parliament. The IPU is a focal point of worldwide parliamentary dialogue and works for peace and cooperation among peoples and for the firm establishment of representative democracy. There are currently 153 member parliaments and 8 associate members of the IPU. The South African Parliament adopted a resolution in 1994 to become a member of the Interparliamentary Union. The conference meets twice a year and consists of delegations from Parliament. A resolution on transparency and accountability in the funding of political parties and election campaigns will be considered by the Third Standing Committee of the IPU Assembly. She says there that it would be useful if the committee, this one, COFTAD, portfolio, could consider the attached draft resolution and propose amendments for the consideration by the 124th IPU delegation. Procedurally, only sub-amendments to the current text will be considered. In other words, not substantial amendments, but as they say, sub-amendments. And then we can then forward those amendments to international relations. So that's basically the request to us to look at this. So we're tabling it with the information in your hand to go and read and discuss so that when we next meet, we must then consider any sub-amendments as you would have understood it. For consideration and approval by ourselves as a committee. So I thought I should start by doing that and then we can then proceed to our next. Any comments on that? No comment? Okay, thank you very much. Members, this morning we agreed that we would We have the we had suggested that members should go and look at the clauses as we discuss them, go and reflect on them and so on. I do have to indicate that my understanding is that whilst we are going through this, we did indicate that the department must also go and sleep over some of the things that we discussed here and so on, and if there are any things they would like to talk to us, they can do so. And we have also received an indication from the Community Law Center, which came here as part of the Good Governance Learning Network, that they would like to take issue with the state law advice on the interpretation. Yes, I put it the way I want it up. We welcomed that. We thought that it is useful to go through this process, looking at these issues from a variety of angles, so that will be helpful. So the court decision that we looked at and its interpretation by the state law advice and the department on the one hand, and the proposals from the Community Law Center, which we considered on the basis of the advice we received. So we thought it was okay to give the Community Law Center an opportunity to just, on the basis of what they have said, to speak on those issues. But perhaps before they do so, I would like to find out from the department whether there is anything else that they have considered that they would like to come back to us this morning, which we didn't talk about in the previous meeting. Any new issues that you are bringing to us?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, you know, based on the request that was made by the committee last Tuesday, there weren't any major, you know, changes that were effected on the proposed amendment. Save just to say that under clause six, which deals with from page 4 of this of the proposed amendments made by the committee, I think members have got copies of the proposed amendments. That the first thing, starting with the heading there, we've amended the heading of that particular clause to read employment of dismissed staff and record of disciplinary proceedings, because the content thereafter deals with all those issues. In particular, we've added, you know, under sub proposed amendment by the portfolio, following deliberations in the portfolio committee. So it is page 4 of this document, and it's not 6.
Yeah. I'm going to request that one of you in the department, Sabi, at the corner there, can you hand over your chair so that they move, Mohammed move this way, and then the member must take it in there, please.
Oh, sorry, okay, yes. Not a problem. I'll put it in.
To move, just move this way so that we have a... you can't be sitting on the periphery here, honorable.
It's okay, I'll sit there.
No, Mohammed. Yes,
yeah. Okay, you've got the documents that we're talking to now, members. Let's proceed.
Yes, the amendment, you know, based on issues that were raised by the committee and Saruga, under sub clause 6, 7, 8, and 9, of that in my proposed amendment,
which
is
page
on page 5 of the document. The first one deals with issues that it actually mandates municipalities to maintain a record of disciplinary proceedings of staff members dismissed for misconduct, as will be prescribed by the minister. And sub 7 also makes provision that such information must be submitted to the MEC for local government on a quarterly basis. And then sub 8 says that upon receipt thereof, the MEC for local government will then submit such information to the minister at national level. And the minister will then maintain a record of all staff members that have been dismissed for misconduct and those that have resigned prior to the finalization of disciplinary proceedings. I know that colleagues have been deliberating over this issue this morning, so we'll give them an opportunity to, the legal guys to lead us on the proposed further changes which they want to make on this particular one. The next clause 10 in the original bill was dealing with the mandating arrangements. So what the proposed amendments here raise, based on the discussed deliberations in the committee last week, is that we're doing away with section 71B of the original bill, and what we've done, we've split section 71B into two. The one part went into section 71 of the Principal Act, which then says that organized local government must, before embarking on any negotiations in the bargaining council, consult with the minister. The other issues relating to the minister's powers, enabling powers for the minister to regulate human resource management system, as proposed by SALGA last Tuesday, have been built under Section 72, which deals with the powers of the minister to make regulations on municipal staff systems and procedures. And in the next page 6, under clause 11, we have tried to make sure that just to give an indication what those would include, that the systems and procedures referred to in here will include everything listed under section 67 of the Principal Act, including, but that they will also include those that we've highlighted, the transfer steps as well as terminations of service. And I think basically those were the amendments that were have been made following the last portfolio committee meeting on Tuesday. But like I said, there were two issues that the legal guys wanted to make some further suggestions on how we can improve.
Thank you. Chairperson, after discussion this morning with SALGA, we'd like to propose that on page 5, that's in clause 6, after subsection 9, we just include the word that refers to this record that the minister must maintain. It said, which record must be made available to municipalities as prescribed.
Where is that located?
In after subsection 9.
9, Roman numeral 3.
It will just be comma after proceedings, and it will say which record must be made available to municipalities as prescribed.
Okay.
That record. Chairperson, another proposal we'd like to make for the consideration of this committee is the bill itself. Clause 7, which deals with the regulations regarding the duties, remuneration, and benefits for municipal managers. It's a new proposed new insertion of a section 59A. Yeah, or 7 on the bill itself on page 6 of the bill. If you look at the Act itself, the Systems Act, section 59 deals with delegation. We feel this is inappropriate where this has been inserted. Section 72 deals with the regulatory powers of the minister. And we would like to propose that this, the wording is inserted in section 72 as a new subsection 2A, 72-2A. In other words, it will be part of the regulatory powers of the minister. That principle. 72, subsection 2A.
Have indeed been consulted with, so we are fine with that. But there's one other issue that I would want to raise. It's a very small one, if I may. It is in the Principal Act, clause 5, 4, well, there are two issues that are small. It is clause 5, 1, 3B, where the employment contract must be signed by both parties before the commencement of the service. So it's page 5 of the bill, 1-3-B, where the requirement is that the employment contract referred to in 1 must be signed by both parties before the commencement of service. We've raised this just as an implementation measure. We agree. Of course it must be signed, but whether one should not put within a time frame, because it doesn't happen that you sign an employment contract before you start. You know, there are all kinds of negotiations that take place, and I think it would be for implementation purposes, server purposes, if you were saying...
What are the original proposals around that? I thought there was some proposals around that originally. Was it not 3 months? Or is that in my head?
No, sir. That's for the performance agreement. That's 3 months.
Okay.
But for the employment contract, if one can say within 30 days after the person has started, that there must be a signed one. Something
okay.
Like that.
That's a slightly different thing.
Because
all right.
What normally happens, Chair, is that there's a letter of appointment.
Yes.
And then there's a short period where you negotiate all kinds of things, and then you sign.
Yeah.
So you want to
pin down a time frame
just
within which...
Just within 30 days.
Okay. Deputy Minister?
I'm actually covered. You answered the question, Chair. The one is a performance agreement. The other is an employment contract.
Okay.
But I know the department feels very strongly about this, because after your last meeting when I was around,
yes,
I did confer with the department officials and asked what's the problem with that. And I forgot. I'm getting old now. So maybe they should be given a chance to say why they feel so why COCTA feels so strongly about it.
That it must be there.
Yeah.
Okay.
They gave some. I've forgotten what.
Yeah. Any further motivation?
The issue, Chairperson, is that the current system, you know, allows for municipal managers and managers, you know, directly accountable to municipal managers to be appointed and not sign employment contracts. You know, in some instances, this goes as far as a period of 5 years and so on. The problem arises when that particular municipality would want to institute disciplinary proceedings against that particular individual. That's the first issue. The second issue is We had thought that we should coin this into the bill to ensure that, you know, the process flows like this. A municipality conducts, you know, interviews, you know, for a particular position, an MM position, and then over a period of time make an offer to a particular individual which it deems suitable for the position. And that particular person should be given about a period of about 30 days wherever he or she is, you know, to serve notice, you know, that he or she will be leaving to join the municipality. The understanding was that that should give that particular individual sufficient time to look at the employment contract, you know, to sign an employment contract. In our view, was you don't have to look. It's different from a performance agreement. You don't have to look into the IDP, the strategy, the SDPs, and so on. But in particular, one of the problems that emerged is once I, as a municipal manager, have been appointed by Municipality X, and I did not sign my employment contract, that spiral into a chain of managers not signing performance agreements, because the process should start with the employment contract first.
Yeah.
Yes. So we currently pushing municipalities to sign performance agreement in terms of the Municipal Performance Regulation 2006. The problem is they are not signing precisely because the municipal manager has got an issue with the mayor or the council on the signing of his or her performance, employment contract, with the result that it affects the second chain of managers and so on and so on.
Any other comments members would like to make on that? Members? I noticed this is the same thing in the public service, that you had a similar thing at the head of department in province and DG as well, that you have a similar thing. So it looks like the time frame within which, I don't know what the current regime is to deal with that issue in the public service, but it has been identified in the past as a problem, that in fact we should be, as part of our oversight work on the department, check whether you guys have signed your agreement in the first place. So that when you, and that's the general approach. So we see the problems that it creates and so on. I hear that. To me, it sounds reasonable to place. And have you considered the department, the time frame? Is a month okay? Does it sound reasonable? What do people in SALGA saying? SALGA, you're saying a month is okay, roughly? Mm-hmm. All right. Any other comment, members? Yes.
You know, from the department side, we're saying at most, if this cannot be signed before commencement of it, then it must be signed on day one. Otherwise, you end up with a person who does not have any employment relationship with the municipality.
Oh, you're saying if you get your employment letter, you must sign a contract?
Yeah.
Why not? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I just want to understand.
Yes.
If you're saying you receive your appointment letter today, you sign the contract today, meanwhile you are still serving your notice from the previous employment. You sign here, but you're still serving paper.
Okay, let's hear Honorable Botha.
I agree with the principle of a time frame. I'm not so sure about signing on day one, practically. First, the employee is on a probation period, I'm assuming. For let's say 3 months. Two, as SALGA indicates, you still have to negotiate certain things with, and the person may want to start. The person to start immediately. So I think honestly, maybe the least you can have is 30 days. Within 30 days after the person has received the employment letter, I think. to say that we sign a contract that will bind you for 3 years, 4 years, within day one, may be a little bit asking too much.
Chairperson, I think that within the 30 days is fine, because that could mean anything from day one to day 30. So if we say within the 30 days. But I think it's crucial that it must be signed. So I'm happy within the 30 days. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm very happy with the 30 days as well, because it does mean, as Honourable Wendy said, that it is within the period of that 30 days of commencement of employ. You can sign that before, but it's only effective from the day that you actually sign and commence employ anyway.
I think it's within the 30 days, making provision for right from the first day or the other day. But do respond to a question about, just go ahead, and you wanted to say something?
Yeah, just as the second issue, Jay, because yeah. I said there were two issues.
Yeah, okay, just before that, let's hear this.
I think one thing that I hear what you know, honorable members are saying. One thing that we also need to have in mind is that there are incidents whereby there are disputes on the signing of employment contracts that we are trying to address here. That if we don't take this into account, we might have situations where some individual municipal managers may still continue, you know, to run, because we're not saying what happens in the event that, you know, a particular municipal manager hasn't signed.
Yeah.
Those are some of the challenges that we are trying to address.
Do indicate, you see, we're trying to let legislation, we're trying to be persuaded by yourselves that the proposals you are making to us to accept this legislation speaks to the issues that you are saying are a problem, and we can see there are a problem if that is so. So do indicate, what are the other issues that you are dealing with, the disputes? What are the disputes about? For example, what would be in the contract that you would object to, that you would want to go and negotiate and then come back? And so is that, what kind of things are you talking about? Give us an example of some of the disputes that often lead and how they can be mediated or dealt with within, yeah. Give us a sense of it so that we operate from at least, yeah.
I think by law, should I say the introduction of the new system of local government that we inherited from 2000 requires of municipal managers to negotiate their conditions of service.
Yeah.
In particular, the salary, remuneration, and related benefits, and so on. And that, you know, makes it, it sort of, you know, opens for municipal managers to take advantage of you know, try to use that opportunity to try and influence council, you know, to be given whatever beneficial packages they can think of. You know, maybe they would need to compare with other individuals from other municipalities, and primarily I'm saying that's one of the reasons. It's around remuneration and benefits.
Do you assume by signing it quickly that they preclude that from happening?
Are you telling me
out? Yes, no. Deputy Minister.
When a post is advertised, let's use arbitrary figures, it's 500,000 rand by
yeah.
end, let's just say. Some of the issues that would be still open, and the cost to company would be 500,000. And this is from experience. It's not the thumbs up, I just want to give you that assurance.
You didn't say that. What the other instances?
No.
I know what you think about them, but that's fine. Proceed.
No. The prospective employee or the prospective the incumbent would negotiate the following, and these are things that do take time. One is what aspect of it to reduce the tax burden would be, for example, the motor car allowance. What aspect is the medical aid issues, the kind of benefits that are derived, the pension issues. Those are quite flexible. So while the overall cost to company is a fix because that's what would the advertisement would say and that's what you would respond to, but within that there are certain flexibilities that prospective employees do negotiate. And that could take some time depending on the availability of the people within council, within the municipality with whom you need to negotiate. And those, it's trying to create that flexibility and allowing for that kind of negotiating to take place.
Just speak to, once you are added to the notice period that the Honourable Nkangeto raised, the notice period.
No, but specifically what in that regard, Chair, with respect to it?
When do you sign a contract so that you are now free of the notice period you may have been serving elsewhere? So there's no conflict between the two, which he was asking.
No, do you allow me to give me a minute or two to answer that one? Because I'm not quite clear in my mind.
Okay.
Regarding there is a practical problem which I need to raise with Jackie in that regard.
Okay.
I'm going to just sound him on that.
Okay.
There's one eventuality that hasn't been addressed.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's give the state law advisor, Mr. Andrew.
Jefferson, thanks very much.
Switch off your thanks here.
The switch is off.
No.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Chairperson, the important part is to be absolutely certain that the Municipal Council and the manager are absolutely clear on what the Municipal Manager is going to do. I think the signing of the contract has less to do with the salary and the benefits than being certain as to what he's going to do. So the minute the Municipal Manager is appointed, then we want to know that the municipal manager knows exactly what he or she is going to do, so that on the day that he commences his or her duties, he or she knows we come into the office to do a particular task. We don't then quarrel about what the duties are going to be. So you settle that before the person starts. For example, a couple of years ago, so long I can't even remember when, I was appointed as the Chief State Law Advisor. I signed the contract long before I assumed the position, so that I and the Minister of Justice at the time knew exactly what functions I'm going to perform. The salary, as Mr. Baba has pointed out, is listed in the advertisement. Everybody knows what salary he or she is going to get, but you want to be certain on that. Now, even if you give the person 30 days within which to sign it, that person then has a time within which that person can raise additional things which that person may want into the in the contract. So you could find that the first 30 days, which is being suggested, is spent simply on negotiating a contract, and then you don't even finalize it. The other disadvantage of that is that once the person is appointed, the person now has some leverage, because the person's been appointed, so the person then says to the Municipal Council, well, I want the following. These are the conditions of service I'm prepared to work on, and the Municipal Council may find that because it's such an important point, the Municipal Council simply has to agree to what that person wants. And so of course, it's a policy decision, Chairperson, which this committee has to take and has to be guided, I suppose, to an extent by the department. But from our perspective, we think it's coherent. We think it's logical, we think it's rational, and we think it's in the interest of good governance that the contract is signed before the person actually commences his or her duties. Thanks.
Okay, Deputy Minister.
I just wanted to ask Jackie, maybe, or I don't know, Fani might be able to respond, or maybe the state law advisor, whoever. What is the process with regard to DGs at national and provincial level? I say this because we're moving towards a single public service. I know some people might say, ha, We heard that 12 years ago. Yeah, it's true, I was chairing the committee at the time, while my comrade was an MEC in the Free State province, right? Some things do take time. But the single public service is torturously slow in its unfolding, but it's there on the agenda. And government and the majority party are clear that that has to be done. There's engagement with the unions around that. That's partly holding things back. So if we're moving towards a single public service, then presumably in the future, the norms that would apply, especially if you're shuffling people around from national to local sphere and vice versa, should be the same. So in short, what is the approach at the moment of the national and provincial sphere? The second thing to say, in fairness to COGTA, there was a lot of discussion in the time that we were processing this bill. And, you know, I'm too old now, Jackie, but I think our arguments are more formidable on why we wanted this than are coming across in this meeting. But unfortunately, the ultimate judge by the portfolio committee is the substance of what we said, not what we should have said. So I think there's more substance to it than seems to be the case with COGTA. But at the end of the day, we can't deliver to a portfolio committee, as I would have said if I was seated there. Tough luck. So, you know, I'm just appealing to COGTA to have one last bite at it, because I think the argument is more substantial than we're making out, but I've just forgotten what they are, because so many things happened between the time we processed this bill in the 6 months from November 2009 onwards to now. But one guide, maybe, Comrade Chair, is that since we're moving towards a single public service, what happened to the national and provincial sphere?
You probably were not yet settled when we raised that question at the beginning of the meeting. What's happening in the context? Yes, and
Chairperson, as far as I'm aware, the contract is signed before the person commences his or her duties. What takes time after appointment is the signing of the performance agreement, and that must be distinguished from the conditions of service contract which the person signs. Because often people then have debates about what the KPIs are and all those things. And particularly for a new municipal manager coming in, the signing of a performance agreement may be quite complex, but that doesn't detract from the fact that the conditions of service laid down in the employment contract will indicate to the municipal manager and others what they have to do immediately on the day that they assume their position.
Yes. But that helpfully clarifies it. But, you know, in your earlier motivation, I seem to be hearing you saying that maybe it was wrong from what you're concluding here, that the space that the 30 days would give to the council is that if there are demands that are unreasonable, irrational, not acceptable, then they can say, okay, jump, we're not accepting you. I thought you were saying it provides that room if it is not signed in advance. I misunderstood you to be saying that from your conclusions.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry, Jay, maybe I didn't make myself clear.
Yes.
I was saying that if you give the incumbent or the person who's going to be appointed,
yes,
an opportunity of delaying the signing of a contract for 30 days after his or her appointment,
yes,
then it provides that person with an opportunity of raising all kinds of things that the municipal council may not have thought about. In other words, it gives the person an opportunity almost of holding the council to ransom to say, well, I've been appointed. If you want me to stay, then these are the things that I want you to agree to. So you want to settle that before the person is appointed and before that person assumes duty.
Okay. No, now I hear it's clear. I'll come back to you, Jackie. Let's hear.
I'm sorry to take you back. Understand on issues of saying now we sign quickly, we find out during those interviews and the like, there are no relevant qualifications to that person that are stipulated in the advertisement of the post?
No. The signing of the contract presupposes that things have been verified.
Yes.
That he's got the qualifications, he's got the everything stuff, and once that has been satisfied and the person has accepted the salary package overall, then the contract gets signed. What then follows are the performance issues. but the requirements for the job, that is the first thing that gets satisfied. Even before you are called, they check on you whether you...
Yes. We are correcting the past mistakes that have been happened.
Exactly.
That's why I'm raising this thing. Even if there were requirements in some instances, in some municipalities, but there were municipal managers who have been appointed without those relevant qualifications.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Wendy?
Jefferson, is Mr. Daniel suggesting that they shouldn't even be aware of the subsidizing?
Yes.
That
must
be signed before. That is a better idea, because I also come out of a municipal background, and I know that is happening. So that really sounds better to me than the city that you want.
Okay. Basically, what we are saying is that let's make some things. Jackie, you were going to speak first before I do what I'm doing. Just go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what the chief advisor was saying, that over and above, the fact that the contract spells out the key responsibilities of the municipal man, it also lays the legal basis for acceptance of the offer of employment. So we should have that in mind as well. That it's a legal basis for acceptance of that particular offer.
That's helpful. Now, and we are saying, what I wanted to say was that the processes before appointment are taken to include verification that the person complies with the requirements as advertised and as taken for granted in the legislation, that those have been verified and the offer is made, and if the person accepts, then he or she signs the contract. And then the other staff can proceed afterwards. Okay. Mohammed Baba?
Yeah. Chair, I want to just remind Jackie, and I think the Deputy Minister was referring to some of the discussions that were taking place. You see, the only actor, the municipality is not the only actor in this. If I recall the discussions that took place before we brought the clause here, and I hope that this would motivate for why it stands at 60 days. The municipality is not the only. While the municipality is the contracting party, there's another player in this, and that's the MEC. There are certain other regulations. There would be a legal difficulty if it goes up to province, the MEC. Remember, there's a role for the MEC here. We're giving that lag period so that those procedures are completed as well.
What is the role? Just remind us.
The appointment of municipal managers, remember that there must be notifications that must be sent at the other sphere of the appointment of this municipal manager.
But that notification can't constitute a veto. You seem to suggest it's a veto.
No, I'm not saying it's a veto. I'm just saying that the argument, the reason why, was to complete those processes, to give us lag time. It's not a veto. But it was for the purposes of information.
So what does it require, the time frame, if that is the case?
Just explain that. I think my colleague Mohammed is talking on a different matter from the one that we're discussing.
Okay.
Because the draft bill, the principal draft bill, it talks of signing of the contract before the date of commencement.
Yes.
And I want to bring to the attention of the committee that we need also to look at this from the position that we've been arguing before, that we're seeking to professionalize the municipal the HR in municipalities, because you can imagine a person getting appointed. You get an appointment letter that says you are appointed. You have a choice to accept the offer or not.
Yes.
After which, you are required to sign a contract,
yes,
which is the contract of employment.
Yes.
And that contract is what we are suggesting, that it should be signed before the date of commencement.
Yes.
Therefore, there can be negotiations about the kind of things that the municipal manager who is appointed is going to do, which is part of the performance agreement.
Yes.
That can be negotiated over time. It may not be signed on the first day, but the contract of employment is what should be signed before the person starts. Because if you don't do that, it means that the person is going to earn a salary on the basis of no contract.
Yeah.
That would not be professionalizing municipal services.
Okay. All right. Any other comments on this that you want to clarify? Is it okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Jafumage. That is the second one.
It's very short, Chair. Line 42. On the same page, page 5, 4C.
Page 5?
Yeah, same page.
Yeah.
42, which is that any regulations or guidelines must be regarded as forming part of the performance agreement. I would suggest that we just delete all guidelines because it's going to be very difficult for guidelines to be regarded as forming part of a performance agreement. The regulations, yes, because
yes.
That's law.
Yeah.
But the guideline must still be adopted by the by the council before it can be regarded as binding.
Sounds reasonable. Yes, Honorable.
Yeah, I don't have a inherent difficulty with that is being said. I just want to ask though, sometimes and the people who are practitioners and the department officials might want to add as well their views. But excuse me, sometimes you want guidelines because you don't want to be prescriptive. And also the diversity of municipalities. Now, one of the key things about Article 1 in Outcome 9 is differentiation of municipalities.
Yeah.
And one of the big problems, those of us, not least the Chair, let me remind you, and Baba, I think what we didn't foresee was that you can't have same powers and functions given to all in the same category.
Yeah.
Like the Metro of Mangaung and the Metro of Etegwini. I mean, they'll be for a while different and so on. So, guidelines are softer. They're not meant to do what I think is being said by Johan.
Yeah.
And maybe it's in the wrong sentence. So he can formulate it and say any regulations, and below that another any guidelines. I don't know. I think we should allow for that flexibility. But I'm not dying in the ditch about it. I'm guided by COCTA officials and the committee.
You sound like you are agreeing to him.
No, I'm not actually. I'm just saying I don't know enough about what really happens to be assertive, but I know enough to know that it's reasonable to have guidelines.
He is arguing, let me say this, he is arguing that in fact precisely because of the reasons of differentiation, you can't then penalize someone that you didn't fulfill your performance requirement by making it part of the contract, of the performance contract. So it ceases to become soft if you now attach it to the requirements of the contract. It transits it. Let me reply.
Yeah. No, I maybe I'm not being clear.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm misunderstanding Johan in particular.
Yes.
But as I understand it, he's saying that we should remove guidelines in that sentence, right?
Yes.
And I'm saying, no, there are circumstances where guidelines would be appropriate, which are not... it's a guide to municipalities on how to approach these performance contracts. It's not a prescriptive regulation. But I don't want to belabor the point, and I don't want the meeting to be held up. So if people don't agree with what I'm saying, that's fine by me. Thank you.
Yes, Fadi.
I'd just like to bring to the attention of the committee chair that in terms of section 120,
mm-hmm.
subsection 6, it says, guidelines issued in terms of subsection 1 are not binding.
Mm-hmm. Issued in terms of what section?
120.
Yes.
Issued in terms of section 120.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Mohammed.
Yeah. No, Chair. I think it's a decision the committee has to take whether we want to be prescriptive or not. If we say guidelines and then in the same breath we say regulations,
yeah,
what we're doing is we're actually giving ACAP and a way to avoid it. We actually sending mixed signals.
Yeah, I agree.
I think within the regulations we can create the differentiation if there is a need for it.
Yeah.
But the differentiation is regulated by obligatory regulations.
So we don't need guidelines in that line.
Precisely.
Yeah, so let's drop it. I think even this statement makes it clear. I mean, like that, any guidelines are not binding. The guidelines and they can be followed where appropriate. Where not appropriate, then people can raise a substantial argument. We don't need to do that. Okay, let's move. Thanks for your huge productivity, even if it's just to Johan. Thankfulness, yeah. Okay, let's... any other comment on those issues that that the department raised and others were not raising? Let's go to the case. And let's do it this way. Maybe the state law advice would like to just restate in summary a couple of lines. The interpretation you gave us of the case as it relates to what we were discussing last week. In other words, that the case, I was about to do it. Let me allow you to do it. Summarize the thrust so that we were also moving from understanding what the Community Law Center was saying. They are here, and then they'll respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll speak from memory, but perhaps my colleague, Yolandi or Kansi, he still want to do it, but if they want me to do it, I'm quite happy to. But they presented our opinion the other day.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jay. I think basically we are all familiar with the facts, so I'm not going to state the facts.
Yeah, okay.
But what it comes down to is the matter of Manana is an exceptional matter. It's not a matter that ordinarily happens within municipalities. What happened was Mr. Manana was supposed to be promoted and receive the remuneration that he was supposed to receive as a result of a resolution that the municipal council took. But the resolution that the council took was as a result or after certain recommendations were made by a presiding officer in a grievance proceeding. So it wasn't the normal case, this one, where the municipal manager would, by way of Section 55, be empowered to appoint or then promote a staff member of the municipality. This was an exceptional matter whereby the Municipal Council took a resolution and whereby Mr. Manana had to be promoted in accordance with that resolution, where it had to be implemented. And the municipality did not implement that resolution. In fact, they found the acting municipal manager said that there were some irregularities, according to them, in the resolution, and that they wanted to withdraw the resolution because of those irregularities that existed in the resolution. And the court found that the resolution was supposed to be implemented because the resolution was taken as part of the executive authority of the Municipal Council, which the Council has in terms of Section 151(2) of the Constitution, and that Section 55, which gave the municipal manager the power to appoint employees, did not divest the municipal council of any of its executive authority. So basically, the only thing that the municipality had to do in this case was to implement the resolution. What we must remember in this instance is that there is two different forms of delegation that we are talking to here. And the court makes it clear also, where the court says that the municipal council cannot always perform their daily tasks, all of their daily tasks, and then they delegate some of their functions. And that we see in Section 59 of the Municipal Systems Act. But with regard to Section 55, the court specifically states that it is a statutory power that is given to the municipal council, after the municipal manager, to appoint an employee. So there's two different delegations that we talk of here. So whereas the second one that relates to the Section 59 delegations can be withdrawn by the municipal council, the first one of the municipal manager cannot be withdrawn. It can only be done by way of legislative amendment. So those are two different ways. And all of those delegations stem from the executive authority of the municipal council, which is a constitutional power given in terms of 151. So the conclusion that we reached was that it didn't have any influence or any impact on any of the amendments that we found in the bill.
Thank you, Chair. Simply put, Chairperson, the court says that municipal managers are obliged to implement decisions taken by the council unless those decisions are set aside by a court. It's that simple, Chairperson, in our view.
Okay. Community Law Center.
Thanks, Chair. The initial input that we made a while ago on this judgment focused on what I think is a bit of a throwaway comment by the Supreme Court of Appeal. And that throwaway comment that the Supreme Court of Appeal makes is the one that worried us. We agree with the judgment in the way, I mean, it makes sense the way the Supreme Court of Appeal dealt with it. That would be the only correct way of dealing with such an exceptional set of circumstances. We also don't have any we don't take issue with the Chief State Law Advisor's opinion. I think it's correct. We just don't think it answers the correct question, because the correct question is, in our view, what do we do with that throwaway comment by the Supreme Court of Appeal, which refers to Section 55(1)(e) in a way that I think is going to confuse a lot of people. So my
what does it say?
Well, the provision in the Systems Act says that the municipal manager, as head of the administration, is responsible and accountable for the appointment of staff, other than the staff referred to in Section 56. Now, what the Supreme Court of Appeal says that this provision does nothing but authorize the municipal manager to act on behalf of the council.
Yes.
Now, the issue on behalf of is a new concept. It's a bit confusing. For those who work in local government, know that the municipal council would delegate authority to office bearers or to staff. You act in terms of a delegation, or you act in terms of statutory prescription, and that distinction was correctly outlined by the law advisor. Now, the issue of acting on behalf of the council is a confusing one. It's not clear. So my plea is to be practical about this. I know that academics are often, we often get told, you know, you're too theoretical, and government wants to be practical. In this case, the academic says, let's be practical and let's leave the theory for another debate. Because the theory about separation of executive and legislative authority is a huge one. And I don't think we should resolve it in this bill. That is my plea. Because the policy position, as we always understood it should work in local government, is that the council sets policy, sets HR policies, recruitment policies, within the national regulatory framework, which is now being firmed up. The council approves the staff establishment, which I think is now also clarified in this bill, that the MM prepares it, but the council approves the overall staff establishment. But the municipal manager makes appointments. The council doesn't make appointments. The council doesn't decide on promotions. The council doesn't make those kinds of individual decisions. There may be exceptional circumstances where you have a power vacuum, which seems to have been the case here, where the council had no choice but to adopt a resolution that clarified matters. It was very exceptional because it had to do with the transitional phase. There was an intervention pending, which the judgment is unclear as to what type of intervention this was. And sometimes these interventions, if they are done by provinces without a clear framework, they can also be very confusing, because then nobody quite knows who decides what. That may be the background to this. So in that exceptional set of circumstances, I think the court was right. But this throwaway comment that actually in the last part of that sort of levels of decision making would be that the council monitors and oversees whether the municipal manager is indeed implementing his policies, and if the council detects that there's a problem with the implementation of those policies, it can request information and it can exercise its oversight powers, and then it can go to the detail. It can ask all the detailed information about an individual appointment. But we always were of the view that the Systems Act sets out this as a framework. Council sets policy, approves the staff establishment, the MM appoints other than the top two levels, and the council oversees and can intervene if there are problems, but post facto. Now, this throwaway comment by the Supreme Court of Appeal unsettled that framework. And I think it's important that the bill provides clarity on. The current content of the bill is not in conflict with the judgment. We completely agree. But we think it should include provisions that firm up the principle that the municipal manager appoints. And this is not new. We have precisely the same configuration in the MFMA, where the council sets policy, supply chain management policy, and there is a very clear principle in the Act that says councillors are not involved in individual tender decisions. They may oversee and they set the policy, but they're not involved in individual tender decisions. So I don't think we need to be too theoretical.
What does the law say? What is the language the law uses to express council appoint, not councillors? What language does the law, rather the law uses to express what you're talking about, Jack? This is the issue that we have problems with. Because the language you use is the one you prefer, that council monitors, council oversees. But constitutionally, the authority to appoint, who does it lie with, according to the law? And how is it expressed in the legislation?
To my mind, the Constitution doesn't give us an answer. The Constitution leaves it to Parliament to regulate the exercise of executive authority by the Council.
Okay.
And I think that includes the authority to set a framework, to say these are the levels of decision-making, and this is where your authority lies.
Okay.
I wouldn't go as far as saying the Constitution gives us crystal clear answer on who, because then we have to say that the MFMA is unconstitutional and that the council makes procurement decisions.
Okay. All right. Let's hear you. That's your view. Yes, Andrew.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we also agree in part with the CLC, but in respect of the on behalf of, bear in mind, Chairperson, when the DG appoints somebody, when the DG in a department isn't appointing on behalf of herself, she's making that appointment on behalf of the department. Now, similarly, when the municipal manager makes an appointment in terms of Section 55, then that municipal manager is making an appointment on behalf of council, not on behalf of herself. She's merely the person who is implementing the policy and carrying out the function assigned to her in terms of Section 55. So we don't think that there is cause for concern, but we agree with the CLC in this sense. If it is ambiguous, and if you can read something else into it, as the CLC says, this new concept on behalf of, then of course there's nothing wrong with clarifying it and amending it. And there we agree with the CLC. In other words, there's no difference between us and the CLC on the issue of whether we need to clarify it and remove an ambiguity.
I don't understand. You just stole my thunder. I don't understand this. Because we... no, before I... Who wants to speak first? Before I speak from the chair. Mohammed? Yeah?
No. Chair, I think we need to go back to the Systems Act. If we read Section 55,
yeah,
it says the following. And let's go back to that and then read the judgment and the concern that the CLC is raising,
yes,
in the light of that judgment.
Yes.
It says, as head of administration, the municipal manager of a municipality is
subject to the policy direction of the municipal council, responsible and accountable for section 55. I forgot my glasses, so I have difficulty. The appointment of staff other than those referred to in section 56, subject to the Employment Equity Act. Now, the question is, the person, Manana, did they first of all form part of section 56? The question is, the answer is no. If the answer is no, then the person responsible for the appointment in terms of section 55, subject to policy, the policy is made by the council, the appointment is made by the municipal manager. Now, the use of the word on behalf, if we are going to give it an interpretation that the municipal manager is a person who takes decisions on behalf of, it wouldn't be on behalf of the council, it would be on behalf of the municipality. The difficulty is, I think the court used the wrong word. If they were going to mean that this person acts within the cause and scope of his or her employment, the municipal manager, then it would have been on behalf of the municipality, not the municipal council, because that, I'm just saying, if that is what was meant, it does confuse it. I think it is a throwaway remark. The simple question is, and our concern last week, Chair, with respect, was, does this impact on the way, does this judgment impact on the way we ought to be looking at local government, again, municipalities and the separation or the so-called role of the executive and the political arm of a municipality? And I think both the lawyers are saying that we shouldn't be concerned. The one is saying that the throwaway remark is unfortunate. It does confuse things. But the simple thing is, will it impact other court decisions, and should we now be careful on how we work in the future and view things? That's the simple answer, and I'm happy, Chair, personally.
Deputy Minister.
excuse me. I'm not a lawyer, needless to say, but I honestly can't see what the practical value is or what the CLC is saying. Actually, I think it's a reverse. YAP is suggesting that this time around, academics are being practical. I just can't see it. all I know is what we've got in the Systems Act is what we intended, and I'm not sure that we need to change anything. When the CLC first came and presented it at public hearings, it seemed like a very sweeping, significant intervention. But on reflection, listening now and having heard the State Law Advisor's office last 2 weeks ago, I'm really not convinced, quite honestly. Maybe I can't see it, but what is really being said? I don't see any need to amend the original Systems Act. I don't see what value it's adding to the current bill before us. And if I'm correct, we were told by the State Law Advisor that where the courts, higher courts, pass a judgment that has implications for legislation, they have a way of, in their judgment or in some form, communicating that to government and saying, like, there's a red flag issue, you've got to do something about it. And they haven't. So, being very practical, though I'm a former academic, maybe my practical bent has a bit more significance, you know. But quite frankly, I can't see it, but maybe it's just that I don't see it because I'm unable to see it.
Okay.
And I'll speak to YAP outside this meeting, but I just can't see it.
All right. No, the YAP is saying that the word the court used on behalf of confuses things. It's likely to create things we wouldn't like to see happening, and wonders whether we want to clarify things in the law. That's what he's asking us to do. What you should say is yes or no to his question. Whether you want to clarify the confusion created by the court by the use of the word on behalf of. Do you think it is sufficiently worrisome
to warrant clarification in the current bill that we are processing now. Because, Enver, you agree, the word is unfortunate and can confuse.
No, no, I didn't say so. What I'm saying is that if the CLC has read into it that it's unfortunate that the court has used it on behalf of,
yes.
I'm saying there's nothing wrong with this committee deciding to make it clear, to remove the ambiguity. We don't think it's necessary. And we said so, and we still say so.
Okay.
But if you can read something else into the judgment that creates confusion, then perhaps this committee may want to.
If both of you are agreed that the only possible... No, okay. If you are agreed that in substance it doesn't affect the issues as we are dealing with now, then I don't think we should then deal with it now here, because you don't want to enter that. From all intents and purposes, the department included. That's fine. We note this concerns raised, but then we will proceed with the way we understand the we now understand the meaning of the judgment. Okay. Yes. Jump, and then we move on to the next one.
Yeah. I'll just one last comment, and then I'll give up. But to me, this is it's not an issue of separation of powers. It's not an issue of the understanding among lawyers and the people around this table of this judgment. In essence, it's an anti-corruption issue. We know that local government is in distress. I mean, it's been widely acknowledged. The corruption takes place in two areas, namely procurement and staff appointment. I think we're in full agreement that this judgment doesn't unsettle the theory of how local government should function. But I'm still very worried about how not us, but how people out there in the local government sector will interpret this. And my cynical view, perhaps overly cynical, is that a councillor or a council would like to interpret this as a judgment that gives it carte blanche to either pull appointment decisions to the council and say, well, you're no longer doing it on behalf of us, we're going to do it ourselves, or to start interfering in staff appointments and actually do that with a mandate from the Supreme Court of Appeal. Obviously, those would be wrong interpretations. They will be incorrect, and I think we all agree on that, because we can... between the judgment of the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Systems Act and the Constitution make sense of how it should be read together. I'm just worried that if there's no clear signal in this bill coming out from Parliament, that it will be misinterpreted in local government.
No. I disagree. And my disagreement is that even as we speak, people who are corrupt don't care what the law says. They don't have to appreciate a gap in the law and go through it. They do it in spite of explicit legislation in place. So fighting corruption must take on a different form. It is not going to be used merely to interpret the law to favor them and say this is how we go through them. And part of the monitoring and evaluation that we understand is what people want to do differently, is that we should, whilst we must tighten up legislation, that we must recognize that it's not going to be the solution to preventing corruption per se alone, but you need other measures. In the entire discussion of this bill, this issue has been coming up repeatedly, and we were agreeing that the law itself is not going to be the only way to close the gaps unless we find that does it, because we would have really solved it a long time ago. So we must find other means in addition to the legislation and so on. But on this instance, I think we are really stretching a jump, in my opinion. Now, I've come to the conclusion that I think you are stretching it, and that the interpretation of the law to hide and use as a thick leaf some potentially ambiguous legislative provision to hide away wrong can happen anytime. So in this instance, I don't think this one, you have persuaded us on it. Yeah. But your reflections about the potential of people using particularly this one can be said of anyone that doesn't even have any cap at all. So we must find other means of doing that, of achieving the object of fighting corruption relentlessly, without fear or favor, and the department doing its job of monitoring what's going on in municipalities, so that along with other institutions, they might take on that campaign much more forcefully than perhaps we have. Yes, okay. Any other comment? I think, yeah, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Sure. I think I just want to ask if the works and the partner in the work. The clause that I think my colleague is referring to in the judgment,
yeah,
that is clause 17, there's the most interesting and important part that they say in that clause. It says, to an extent that there might be any ambiguity in that in the statute, in that respect, it must be construed to avoid that result. The judge is very clear and expressly there.
Mm.
It says any ambiguity that arises out of the interpretation of the statute,
yes,
it has to be avoided to create that ambiguity.
Yes, it's the last paragraph.
It's the last paragraph.
It says it does not divest the council of its authority to prevent this. So even if a monkey claims to interpret it one way or another, the council has authority to say nonsense. You're out of order, this is not your responsibility, or the other way around. Whoever else has political responsibility and legal responsibility for that interpretation. Okay, thank you very much.
I don't know if it's of any value. I know these reports to Parliament don't carry legal substance, but presumably the committee might want to consider a paragraph or two and saying this matter was discussed and this is the understanding.
You're writing our report.
No, I'm saying presumably the committee would want to consider. I'm not even saying you should consider. I'm saying presumably you'd like to consider it. Because the reason for that is, in the past, as you know, Comrade Chair,
yes,
now and then people have referred to reports to Parliament. I think in one judgment as well, not our report.
Yes.
For what it's worth,
yes,
when we've had discussions with like the House Chair about what is the value of these reports,
okay, yes,
it has been raised that it does help sometimes in judgments, but they look at the report. What did Parliament intend,
yes,
even if it's not? And when the Transnet Act that we passed,
yes,
interestingly, we could not deal with a legal issue. And we were advised by the Parliament's lawyers and by the Department of Public Enterprises lawyers that the way to deal with a problem about how you allocate the money and so on and who gets it,
mm,
old order and new order, you can't deal with in legislation, but it does carry some semi-value to put in the report. So if the committee feels of any value, it might want to consider that.
No, we do it for political reasons when we do that, because in the first place, people feel that they come to us, present their views, we don't regard their views seriously, and we proceed. It's for political reasons. In addition to also an objective account of what happened here, there are positions that were argued by COSATU strongly. That why do you want to use law? You telling us you want to deal with corruption, why do you use other methods? Why are you hiding away from doing those things? So in the way in which we report, we must try and identify the considerations that we made in arriving at the conclusion that these amendments must be made and so on, including the one that you are making. It's a useful suggestion in any case. But I think I'm saying that they are good, it's a good account of the processes as they took place here. So we should be able to reflect these issues properly and so on. And this is why, I mean, like we thought, I felt strongly about it initially that, look, there might well be something here that we are missing. And if we are really missing it, let's see it. If we don't, and we finally think that no, we have arrived, that no, we now see it from a variety of angles, let's proceed with a different understanding. This is why I thought it's crucial that we call the Community Law Center back here so that we consider their observations. But thank you very much. We appreciate the effort into the exercise and so on. Yes. Any other comments on the bill, members, that you want to let us know? None. Okay. Marty, you can tell us where your colleague is.
Marching.
He's marching. Which way is he marching? No, it's procedurally. I didn't ask for any apologies because I saw my team full, so I didn't bother. Yeah, okay. All right, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Just a comment on the processes. I also want to appreciate maybe the time that the committee has given itself to even take the program, to stretch it up to so far, repeatedly calling other stakeholders who has had strong amendments in this bill to come and present before the committee, of which we've been able to give them space and time to express their views, and we express ours. So I want to appreciate and maybe to highlight what we overstretched our program on public hearing to give other stakeholders time to make a law. To put stress in their submission.
Okay. All right, yes. Thank you very much. I'm just going to say that we are working with programming. We will only vote on the bill and finalize it, in other words, once we have had indications from programming about when they want to locate us. So in the meantime, members, your parties here and so on, and Meditel, your caucus still has an opportunity to go in.
The biggest caucus
in Parliament, yes. has an opportunity to still reflect on the matter. We are in touch with programming, and once they come back to us with an indication of a date and so on, we will then be able, working backwards from there, to say the next meeting is the only meeting during which we won't take 10 minutes, I assume, in finalizing the bill itself. But I think we've had enough discussion and debate around it. We'll just let it percolate, and then we'll come and vote for it here. We are unable to do that because we want to get the programming people to advise us on the timing of the bill and so on, and some time to put together a report of sorts. Any other matter members would like to let us know? The department, we have I don't know how much time we have between now and the local government elections. Time and so on. You're not going to surprise us with any legislation. Is there any legislation in the offing that we must talk about? Honorable Minister.
The Municipal Property Rates Amendment Bill.
Yes.
But it's going to cabinet cycle in 2 weeks' time. It's ready. Jackie, I need to speak to you about that. That's the only bill for now. The Provincial Intervention in Municipalities and National Intervention in Provinces Bill, the Section 139, that is finished as far as COCTA is concerned. We're now passing the consultation, including with you, Chairperson.
Okay.
That'll begin in the next week or so. And then there is, that I presume is not something that needs to be passed before the local government election. It's a complex and difficult and challenging bill. And that will require, you know, obviously much more considered attention than this bill. So we hope, in terms of our cabinet requirements, I think that bill has to be taken to Parliament in May, is that right? May, is it? May.
Yes.
May. So the elections are in May, so that's not before. And then after May, there is the amendment to the local, the Traditional Leadership Framework and National House of Traditional Leadership Bill. That will come to you in June in the second cycle.
Okay.
But for this, there's only the Property Rates Amendment Bill.
Okay. Just to say that from my desk, the issues that we will talk about is this IPU debate. I would like members to take that seriously. It's an important one. We're trying to suggest that people who go and represent us in international forum must have our mandate. It mustn't run like Tazami the Porter to certain functions without mandate. So they must get our mandate, so we must properly discuss, suggest amendments and so on and so on, and come back and say what does it mean for us in this parliament. We can't go on talking about things there and not be discussing them in our own parliament. So that's the one thing. The second thing, Deputy Minister, We would like to get an update on the disaster management issues. It's been a concern to us that we have not been able to move out to visit the areas ourselves to do that. The last time we had a briefing from yourselves, so we would like to get an update of what's happening. The issues of flood, fire and drought, and the implications for that, and issues relating to water. Deputy Minister and the department, this issue of water is a critical one because of the impact it's going to have on migration as well. So if we think that the Masondo, the mayor, the chairperson of SALGA, has often identified urbanization as a key challenge of municipalities, and some of this what I now call climate-induced conditions on the ground are fast-tracking movement of people to areas they think are better than others elsewhere. So it's really going to be a major issue. So we would like to be posted on that thing. We are going to be discussing with programming to give us some space to go to some of the places to interact with people ourselves. So that will be a useful one to find a way to let us be posted around those issues. Thank you very much. Thank you, members. I'm sorry, members. Members, it's okay. The department can progress to go. When we were preparing the budget review report recommendations, one of the requests made by the House Chairman on behalf of Parliament was that we must be talking to the department and others we interact with about their impact on the achievement of Millennium Development Goals. And so we need to be doing that. So as part of our work in talking to the department as well, and municipalities generally, we should find a way in which we integrate consideration of the achievement of Millennium Development Goals. So let's make this, we will factor this into our program. So be thinking about that as we proceed. So I just forgot to raise this with you. Thanks, Shirin, for reminding me. That's it, yeah, thanks.
You must work interactively with the department regarding the Millennium Development Goals. That's why you think you should do it. How do you should interact with the department?
You must interact with the department, with the budgetary processes in place regarding the Millennium Development Goals.
This zone, we are the biggest family.
Now, you have a garden.
there are certain
Yeah, I'm going to